I know you have missed the GRQ podcast, but episode 111 brings Blakey, who loves to talk in third person, back with another special interview. This time, Mr. Michael Thomas, the Director of Instruction at Chartwell Golf and Country Club in Maryland, USA, has been very gracious with his time in joining the podcast to share a bit of his story, how he got started in golf, and his rules of golf journey. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with Michael just before he headed away for his 13th USGA Rules Workshop in Nashville. But just before we get into that episode, I want to encourage you that if you like these podcasts, please share it with a friend or two. Send them a link and get them listening. As well as the podcast, Stuart and Blakey also produce The Drop Zone, which is a weekly rules newsletter that gives you some helpful hints, a few rules questions, and there is usually a funny video to keep you entertained and educated. So send us your email address if you have yet to sign up. And when you receive the newsletter, make sure to forward that on to your captain or manager at your club. They are free to distribute it to all of their club members. We also have merchandise that you can purchase so that you are representing the best golf rules podcast in the world. Grab a t-shirt, a hat, or even a hoodie featuring the Rules Roo or the Wombat Caddy. And now, whether you're in your car or going for a walk or just taking a break after mowing your lawn, enjoy this episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast.
Highest ranked working rules officials that we have. One of the best we've got. And he knows he's so.
Just before we get into episode 111 of the GRQ podcast, we need to cover off our previous esteemed guest, Mr. Tim Murphy's GRQ OTW, which was Barney, the B grade golfer, hits his approach shot into a greenside bunker on the short 15th hole of the very prestigious golf club at Wombat Hills. The ball was in the middle of a large collection of temporary water in the middle of the bunker. As the only relief area in the bunker would put the ball in a very difficult position on a slope, Barney decides to take back on the line relief outside of the bunker. After making this decision, Barney walks into the bunker to retrieve his ball. In doing so, he creates footprints. Barney retrieves a rake and smooths those footprints, and then correctly drops his ball outside the bunker. But instead of using back on the line relief, he changed his mind and has now taken stroke and distance relief from a distance fairly close to where back on the line relief would have put him. But before playing his shot, Barney notices that the raked footprints are in his line of play for the short shot over the bunker to the hole that was a mere 6 feet onto the front of the green. After playing his shot, how many total penalty strokes has Barney incurred? And the answer is, Barney has correctly taken stroke and distance relief for a penalty of 1 stroke. He was allowed to change his mind on which option he was choosing as he made the change before the ball was dropped. His actions to care for the course are allowed as per rule 12.2b3, because when Barney had intention to take relief outside the bunker, he was allowed to touch slash smooth the sand, even if it was on his line of play, which in this case it was. It was a very good question by Tim. And now, without further ado, let's get into episode 111 and Blakey's interview with Mr. Michael Thomas.
Welcome, everyone, to the Golf Rules Questions podcast. Alongside me, we have a special guest, Michael Thomas, all the way from Maryland in the States, or as most of my listeners are in the States, you'll know exactly where that is, whereas I probably do not. Thank you very much for coming on and telling us your story on the Golf Rules Questions podcast, Michael.
Absolutely, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. And as I mentioned to you before, you know, somebody told me 10 years ago that my rules of golf journey was going to have me on a podcast with someone from halfway around the world, about 4 or 5 heads, but yet here we are, and I'm looking forward to a good conversation. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Have you actually ever been down to Australia or New Zealand?
I have not had the opportunity to get down to Australia or New Zealand, but I will tell you, it is on my bucket list because there's some wonderful golf down there, like Cape Kidnappers and those types of things that are down your area. Those are on my bucket list of places I want to get to. So one of these days when it's looking like retirement age for me in about 20 years, that might be when I end up getting down that way, but we'll see how things play out. It's on the bucket list.
Yeah, definitely. I've only ever been to around your area, around New York, Pennsylvania, the once, and it is a fair way to go. I think it would be around 20 hours at least in the air. If you fly via Los Angeles, so it is a fair way to trek. But so you're what club are you at the moment, Michael?
So where I work at Chartwell Golf and Country Club, which is in Severna Park, Maryland, just north of Annapolis, where the U.S. Naval Academy is located. We're about 20 minutes north of there, about 20 minutes south of Baltimore. If you go 20 minutes north of Annapolis, 20 minutes south of Baltimore, and about 30 minutes east of D.C., you'll run right into my club, Chartwell.
And you're the director of golf?
I'm the director of instruction there. Made a transition to full-time instruction right around COVID time. Used lockdown as an opportunity to reevaluate my career path from the head professional director of golf role into full-time teaching. Somebody asked me after a couple of months of doing it, you know, how I liked the transition. And I said to them, I said, you know, I gotta be honest. I think I made a really big mistake. And they're like, oh, really? I go, yeah, I never should have stayed a head professional that long. I'm like, teaching full time is fantastic. And so you get to really connect with players on a level that I've always enjoyed and used it as a bit of a platform to get a little deeper into my rules involvement and be able to make my own schedule and do some more refereeing, do some more officiating and be involved at a little deeper level than I even had been before.
Now that is a really interesting thing that you said there, because director of golf, head professional, you know, you're involved more in events, member, guest, member type events.
Yep.
And you'd think that, you know, you'd have your rules knowledge and your rules aspect and your local rules and all those hats on.
Absolutely. And it served me, my rules knowledge served me really well in those capacities to be able to run the club-wide events, because you know, if you want to talk about some complicated rule situations, your recreational golfer can get themselves into some pretty funky rules situations that you got to be able to sift your way through and give a good ruling. In fact, it was, you know, when I took over as the director of golf at the facility where I was at that point, first day on the job, the general manager said to me, listen, if you can come in and figure out this rule situation on hole number two and whether or not these balls are actually out of bounds or inbounds with where this fence is located, then I think you'll have done your job for the year. And I was like, it's fantastic. And I went out the next day and I did a video about which balls were inbounds and which balls were out of bounds. I sent out to the membership and I took the rest of the year off. It was fantastic.
That's awesome. So it's an interesting thing, because you're sort of cutting your teeth as that director of golf and learning your rules. And we'll get into your rules knowledge in a second. But just, you're cutting your teeth, but it's mainly just recreational or amateur golf that you're looking after there. Now, when you move to head of instruction, how many sort of lessons are you handing out a week, or how many people are you seeing sort of a weekly?
Well, you know, it's a little seasonal where I am. So we're in the middle of winter right now. And so I'm not nearly as busy this time of year as I normally would be. I'm teaching about 15 hours a week or so right now. But in season, I mean, it's 40 hours or more a week. I'm doing everything from beginner lessons. I do all of our junior programming, our junior league golf teams. I think I have about 40 players on my junior league golf teams. We ran about 100 different players through our Operation 36 group classes last year. And then I have probably, last I counted, it was north of 200 individual students that will see me at least multiple times a year. I don't really count the one-offs as much, but I think last year I taught about 1,200 hours or more.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, just on that, because it's winter at the moment, do you have like an indoor teaching facility as well?
I do, yeah.
Or something like that?
Yeah, we have a single room indoor sim. that is just in a self-contained building over. It's actually off the back of the fitness building. So it doesn't open up to our driving range, but that's where I'll do all my teaching in the wintertime. That's my default, unless the weather happens to be really nice. So I'll be in there. I'll be in there pretty much through. I always plan on maybe first or second week of April getting back outside. That's when I start all my group classes. First week of April, April 4th this year is actually when I start. So yeah, that'll be my plan. As long as the weather holds out and as long as it starts getting warm, we'll be in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Our daylight's starting to lessen and it's not getting too cold here in February, but it will in March and April, whereas yours will start heating up. So it'll be very nice. So I would recommend if you ever do come to down to Melbourne, come around end of Feb to end of April. And the same for Tasmania, if you go to Barnbougle or if you go to King Island.
Got it.
End of February to end of April is the best time to come down here.
Noted. So that sounds like the perfect time because it's the coldest here. So that's fantastic.
It is, absolutely. We have sort of if you're going to say that we had the least amount of wind, it would be sort of that time would be the least amount of wind and not too cold. But I mean, one of the good things about Melbourne or the whole of Australia, you can pretty much play golf 365 days. We don't have any place that has snowfall or anything like that, like on the ground. It might have been half a day, but it's a pretty good spot for that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah, we always end up getting these periods of time too in the middle of our winter, and it gets nice. I can do a few lessons outside. You know, we're in this transition zone between the really cold states up north and the really warm states down south, to where we'll get a little bit of snow here and there, but then it seems like the next week it's 65 degrees and all the snow melts and people want to get out, and the golf course will be, you won't be able to get a tee time for 2 or 3 days, and then all of a sudden it'll turn to be 32 degrees again and everything refreezes and then you're stuck back inside. So everyone gets out and gets rid of their cabin fever for a little while, but then we end up getting shut back indoors for 5 or 6 weeks at a time.
Yeah, because around that sort of March, I think I might have been over there almost, but around the end of February, March, you've had some polar freezes in the last sort of decade.
Oh. Yeah, we had a couple, about 10 years ago now, maybe 12 years ago, where we got like 36 inches of snow in February. It happened in December, and then again, like 8 weeks later in February, we had like 70 something inches in a matter of 4 months. And for this area, it was just kind of nuts. But yeah, you're exactly right. That those polar freezes come in, and then all of a sudden, 4 weeks later, it's springtime, and you're like, where did that come from? But yeah.
I like to find out a bit more about about who I'm interviewing as well, but most of the listeners just want to hear about rules. So your rules journey, where did that all start? Oh, actually, let's go even further back. When did you start playing golf?
So I started playing golf when I was about 4 years old. My dad introduced me to the game. I was very young. He was a recreational golfer. Self-admitted weekend hack. picked that habit up from his father, my grandfather. I would say up until I was in my 20s, I never took it seriously. I'm one of the rare guys you'll see out there. I'm a club professional, but I actually did not play competitive golf in high school. I didn't play competitive golf in college. In fact, my journey had me at about a 20 handicap when I was 20 years old, when I decided that I really wanted to get into the golf business, started taking things a lot more seriously. And then, where I ended up, that leads to how I kind of got introduced to the rules of golf. After I graduated from Penn State with a degree in psychology, I ended up going down to a little school that's no longer around. It was called the Golf Academy of America, and it was an associate's degree program to get you started in the golf business, because I wasn't a good enough player yet to try to get in the PGA of America. So found a different route to get me into the golf business. And it was a 4-semester program, and 2 of the semesters you studied the rules of golf. And so basically this first semester in your rules of golf, it was the rules of golf book. And then the second semester was what then at the time was the decisions book. And you basically covered each book from cover to cover. And for whatever reason, it all kind of made sense to me. And I did really well in the classes. And I had a lot of rules knowledge when I came out of it, more so than I ended up getting when I started going through the PGA of America's education program. And so when I ended up getting a job in the golf industry, I was the most knowledgeable professional on staff, even though I was the youngest and newest and had not been as experienced in tournament play. Guys that were working at the club, my general manager and head professional, when they had a rules question, they came to me. And I said, all right, well, there's something here. I kind of know what I'm doing. And the position I took after that, the person who was the director of golf at that club, that was actually, I went to Woodmont Country Club, which is where they actually hold the sectional qualifying for U.S. Open every year. I have every year since 1987. So some big time tournaments come through there. And director of golf was a expert level rules guy. And he and I had good conversations. And he's the one that suggested I start attending the USGA workshops. And tomorrow morning I leave for what I think, if my count is correct, will be my 13th USGA workshop. I've been going pretty much every year since 2011. Only missing 2020 when they canceled them because of COVID.
Wow. So I think you're going to Nashville tomorrow?
Going to Nashville, yep. Tomorrow morning, leave for Nashville.
Is that usually where you go, or have you been other sort of spots?
No, that's the first time I'm going to go to the one in Nashville. I've been to the one in New Jersey at USGA's Golf House several times. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, so I've attended – I think two in Pittsburgh, using it as a chance to go up and visit my family. And besides that, I usually go to the one in Richmond in Virginia, but just happens to conflict with some other meetings I have going on the following week for our Mid-Atlantic PGA section. So the Nashville one just happened to work out, and that's where I'm headed.
Yeah, fantastic. I think this episode will probably happen after you come back from that. But hopefully anyone listening to the pod was able to reach out to you and, strike up a friendship over the rules of golf. But it's quite interesting sort of, you went down the college route and went psychology. Do you use any of your psychology when you're sort of teaching your instruction at the moment?
I would say that if an instructor out there is looking for something to make themselves better, get a degree in psychology. Yeah, wow. I think I use it pretty much every day.
Yep.
Just how you relate to people and how you can understand how they learn and think about things. And, I don't necessarily pull out my old psychology textbooks to try to figure things out when it comes to teaching the game. But I think my background in psychology has given me a pretty unique perspective on handling folks during lessons and to an extent handling rulings on the golf course. Being able to understand kind of what the players are going through and have the empathetic ear, so to speak, to deal with what can sometimes be obviously some contentious situations, depending on what you're trying to tell the player. So I think it has definitely helped in both aspects of my career now. Yep.
What's the what is one of those sort of situations where you've been in as a referee and you've tried to the players got a little bit heated or got a little bit confused and you've tried to calm them down a bit?
Yeah, I think I've been fortunate that I haven't had too many really contentious situations, but I think the hardest ones are pace of play. Because they don't really want to have that conversation. They don't want to be told they're slow, and if they're dupes behind and they're on the clock, you got to handle that with some ease. Sometimes, I think the most contentious we had was there was a gentleman playing in a pre-qualifier that I was one of the officials in charge for a PGA Tour event a couple years ago, who had some pretty significant unsportsmanlike conduct on the course when he was having a couple of bad holes and ended up cursing out a referee who was trying to get him to calm down and not damage the golf course with his golf cart. And so we had to remove that player from the event. So that was probably the most contentious one I've had to deal with, just somebody getting pretty heated at themselves in their play, not really a ruling per se, except for the fact that he didn't want to be taken out of the event. But I think he learned a lesson and he's better for it. So that's good.
The interesting thing about that from a referee point of view is how many times have you found yourself in that situation before?
That's the first time for that situation for me from a referee. And so you're going into it, your heart's racing, your adrenaline's pumping, and you're trying to keep yourself calm, knowing that you're really going to get under this guy's skin. You don't know what he's about to do. It was one of the few heart pounding situations I've had on the golf course, but it was needed. And you never want to have to do that for a player, especially he was probably a couple of strokes away from having a good chance of making it through the pre-qualifier and getting in the Monday qualifier. And he's a good player who's, you know, young kid up and coming. And, again, hopefully, you know, learned his lesson and doesn't happen to him again. And he can have a good career afterwards.
That's one of the most interesting things. Sometimes you find yourself on the golf course in a situation with a player that you've just never experienced before. Like, even the most experienced people can have some new situations, and they have to find a way from their experience, from their knowledge, and at the same time, exactly what you said, have that empathetic feeling towards the player of what they're going through. It's some interesting, and you know, as you said, your heart gets racing and you're like, I've got to try and deal with this. And then, you know, there's a couple of other people in the same group trying to deal with it, and they're trying to make the cut or make a good score.
It's exactly right. And I think that's, you know, for me personally, that's one of the things about the game just in general that always has intrigued me, is that no 2 days are ever the same, right? And you can have, as a referee out on the golf course, you'll have your standard, here's the relief options, here's what you're able to do, not able to do, those types of things. Yes, that ball is embedded, you know, those types of things. Those are the easy ones, right? I mean, that's just the player making sure they're doing the right thing. And when you start getting, you know, you're always going to find a situation just like you will when you're a player. You find yourself in a situation you've never been in before, and I think that's what makes it fun. That's what makes it interesting. And that's why you keep doing it, is because you never know what's going to end up coming out of it.
Yeah. No, that's good. I think with your, certainly as well as the psychology, learning the psychology, just actually going through college, sitting exams.
Sure.
Learning the literal meaning of each word, certainly in psychology, and then applying that to the rules of golf would have been why you topped the class pretty easily.
I think it did help me quite a bit. You know, coming right from a university and then going to that associate's degree program, you know, a lot of the folks that were in that school with me were either high school graduates, not recent college graduates, or they were starting a second career. There were some folks that had retired as police officers, or had gotten out of the military, or whatever the case may be, and were looking for a second career. And so it had been 8, 10, 20 years since they had been in the classroom. And I was fortunate that I was able to just keep that mentality going and ended up doing fairly well. And then I had a few year hiatus. I graduated from there 2004, and I didn't have my first rules of golf workshop with the USGA until 2011. So there's 7 years where I didn't study the rules per se, but I still always had the rules book handy, right? And still always referring to it when people were asking me about rules. And I became a sort of my own student for a while. And I've enjoyed being a resource for my fellow professionals who aren't at the same level of knowledge that some other folks are. And they need help sometimes. And I still get friends of mine. I get friends all the time who call me and you know, they're in the middle of their member guest and have something happen on the golf course, and my phone will ring while I'm on the lesson tee and try to help them out with the rules and give them a ruling for their member guest while I'm on the lesson tee. So it gets interesting sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I know that, and I give, certainly instructors in Australia, give them stick on the pod pretty often, because their rules knowledge is pretty shocking, is what I would say. And the reason I say shocking is because they are our first point of call. Like, when the member comes in and they have a situation, or if the member's out in the golf course, who are they going to call? And it's not Ghostbusters. It's the guy in the pro shop, and that might be the head pro. It might be just you know, the kid that's just there to sell Mars bars.
Yep.
And they don't see the bigger picture of why it's so important to have some rules knowledge at least. Or if you don't know, or you know what you don't know, so you don't know the rules, so you know that, you know, tell the player, look, wait, I will go and get some more information. I will ask someone else. You know, I will call up Michael. He's just given a lesson, but he loves the rules. I'll just take 20 seconds of his time just to find the ruling for you.
Yeah, and that's a, I think it's a, I'm going to say it's an, if there was one thing that I would change about, you know, I'm a proud member of the PGA of America. I love the PGA. I've been involved with my section. I've been on our section board. I've been to the national meetings. I think a lot of what the PGA of America does is fantastic, and there's always room for improvement. And one of the things that I think can be improved is the education of our professionals as a whole, but specifically, you know, my education on the rules did not come from the PGA of America.
Yeah.
You know, it was at the Golf Academy of America whenever I was doing that associate's degree program, which was not a PGA of America program.
Yep.
And then my own personal, you know, investment into going to the USGA workshops.
Yep.
Beyond that, there's a very limited amount of rules education necessary for PGA professionals here in America. And it sounds like the same way down in Australia. And it probably is that same way for a lot of folks around the world. And I don't really have a great answer as to why, but selfishly, it helps me stand out from the rest of the crowd. So I guess, you know, I'm just going to keep it going. And if I can be a resource for everybody else and you know, selfishly keep that as a little bit of a feather in my cap, then that's just the way it's going to be for now. And I have no problem helping out other pros who need help with the rules. I would much rather they call if they don't know the answer than give bad information, because there's, as you well know, there's plenty of bad rules information out there that recreational golfers talk amongst themselves and do amongst themselves and what they think is correct, and then get themselves in trouble when it actually is more meaningful in bigger tournaments. But so I'd much rather, you know, be a resource, and have them call me when they need to.
That is actually a really good point. If everyone was really good at the rules, then I probably wouldn't have the job that I have as well. So, but it is interesting, you know, that the priority is not placed on rules. Recreational golfers, you know, even the book says that everyone is supposed to know the rules, put in their own effort, as you and I have done. And I mean, that was basically the reason that I started Golf Rules Questions. Yes, it was to help some people out on social media, but mainly it was just to educate myself, because just like you, who looks for people to, other instructors to call up Michael, I was looking for social media to ask me questions, and then I would go and research so that I learnt learnt the answers.
For
myself as much as for them. So it is a good point. I mean, with other sports, whether it's football or baseball, basketball, they all have umpires, as we know. Mm-hmm. Recreational golfers, you don't see too many referees out there on course with them.
And like you said, your local pro, your person in the golf shop, they're sort of your local referee. And, you know, if they don't have an extensive rules knowledge, it can be detrimental sometimes. Yeah. But, the desire to know the rules, a lot of folks have at least a cursory understanding of the rules to where they can remember how to drop out of a red penalty area versus a yellow penalty area, hopefully. But they won't even know them to the extent that we know them, which is the same reason that, like, if anyone was watching the Super Bowl, you're going to have a rules official, an NFL referee in the booth that Jim Nance can go to and say, okay, how come this rule is the way this rule is? You know, yeah. And Jim Nance knows the rules. Tony Romo played the game. He knows the rules, but they don't know to the extent that the officials do. And so having that expert you can call on, I think, is important. And I like that they've started doing
–
similar things in all the sports where they've got an official in the booth for PGA Tour events and DP World Tour events, where they can get some explanation as to what's going on at the golf course, because, you know, like them or not, the announcers don't give good information on broadcasts a lot of times when it pertains to the rules of golf. So, you know, and I'm not going to call anybody out specifically, but, you know, we all know folks are listening to things on TV that we're like, that's blatantly incorrect. Right. And so I like that they've taken the opportunity to have an official sort of on call for a lot of broadcasts, and they can go to and get some answers to their questions.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Talking about that, I mean, talking about football, you got Mark Dispovid, who used to play football, is now a referee on the PGA Tour, and he is constantly used as the TV referee, which is fantastic. I mean, on Live Golf, we have Tony Zappoli that they go to when they need him to clarify. And as we sort of said, David Stabler says the rules are easy, but the facts are hard. And so he's not only clarifying what the rule is, but also looking at what the facts are from the coverage. So it's exactly what you're saying. But so your actual, you know, you've gone through the study, you've decided to become a head professional, and you also have this ammunition of being excellent with the rules of golf, and then you decide to go just before COVID, sort of, or during COVID, go as a head instructor. But your actual, not only the education of your rules and your 12 or 13 USGA courses, but the actual on course, when did that sort of start? Your on course refereeing and going down that sort of path?
Yeah, it wasn't long after my first attended the Rules of Golf workshop. So my first workshop was 2011, and I want to say the first time that I got a call or was able to offer my services to like a local association was probably 2013. It took me a couple of years of taking the exam to get an understanding of how to take the exam and get a good score that they would. I think my first exam score was in the mid 80s. But by the third time I took it, I'd achieved a 92 or better, which is expert level in the USGA. So, once I got, those types of scores and the local associations got wind of that, I started getting calls to be, you know, an official on these three holes, or, you know, be a referee that handles these three or four matches in our amateur championships and that kind of thing. And that all started in 2013. So I've worked events for the Maryland State Golf Association, the Mid-Atlantic Golf Association, the Washington Metropolitan Golf Association. And then I also am now the committee chair for our Mid-Atlantic PGA section, Rules of Golf Committee Chair, and I'll work our section events sometimes as well. So, and then I alluded to some of the PGA Tour qualifiers I've been involved with, and it's just been growing and growing and growing ever since. But yeah, I think the first events I did were back in 2013, and then 2022 was my first PGA Tour qualifier event.
So with the golf associations, that's you're sort of like your amateur body?
Correct.
And then the sectional, that's more you're like your PGA body, right?
That's the PGA professionals, yep. Yep. Okay. So amateur, yeah, the associations are the amateur associations that run all of our amateur events around, and then our PGA section would be all my fellow club pros playing.
Yeah. And yep. Are there mini tours around that you work with as well?
I haven't done any mini tour events. It's been mainly our amateur associations and the PGA. You know, still working full time. There is only so many days I can take away from the lesson tee. you know, as a to go volunteer for those type of things. But I think one of the neatest things that I've been involved with, and I'm proud to be involved with, and has taken me to some has taken me on a pretty cool journey, has been the PGA Junior League Golf, which is our sort of little league for golf. And those on the listening to the podcast that don't know what that is, it's a very fun and relaxed format for junior golfers.
Okay.
So basically, ages 8 to 17. You don't need to have any experience in golf whatsoever. It's two-person scramble match play. But because it is run nationally, we've got to have an overarching set of rules that everyone's going to abide by, even though it's scramble format. And so we have a committee of, you know, more than 12 people between the PGA's national office and then PGA professionals like myself from around the country who've gotten together over the years and continue to develop the rules that this thing is going to get governed by. And then I've been able to go be the official on site for some of the regional events and see some of these kids who are just phenomenal players. And they go out there, and when I say phenomenal players, I mean, yeah, they're playing a scramble, but you know, you have a couple 13-year-olds who are playing a two-person scramble, and for 9 holes, they go out and shoot 27, right? like no problem. And I'm watching these kids, and I'm like, I mean, they're driving the greens on par fours and hitting every par five and two, having eagle putts all over the place, and it's fun to watch and see them develop over the years. And I run our league teams at Chartwell, and we've got some pretty good players, and then we'll go and try to compete the section event and just get absolutely walloped by bigger fish in a bigger pond. So then to be able to, you know, go officiate for some of those kids as they continue to move up through the championship season has been pretty cool. So that's been a really rewarding sort of give back to the game to be able to do that at the national level.
So with the scramble, what have you sort of modified slightly in terms of those rules? Do you allow tap-ins?
So we do. We have it as a pretty specific,
yep.
You know, we have it as a pretty specific requirement that if a player rolls a putt, and we looked at it in the sense that, like a lot of rules, they're not looking to trap. We're not looking to trap the players, right? We don't want to end up the players get a penalty for doing something that they just would normally do, right? So if player A and B on a team, you know, have a 20-foot birdie putt, and player A rolls it up to 4 inches from the hole and goes and taps it in, okay, we say that B can still have a shot at that birdie putt, right? But if A misses, now A's ball has to count and B doesn't get a chance. So if A misses the tap in, B is not allowed to putt the birdie putt. You're going to have to count A's score, and that's it. You're done.
So it really puts in
like, all right. What I tell the kids before they go out to play is, listen, if you think you need to mark it and line it up, just mark it and wait.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Because we don't want to end up, player A hit it 5 feet past, and yeah, now they want to see if he makes the comebacker, right, before B takes his putt. Okay. Because there could be some advantage there.
Yeah.
But if you're 4 inches or 8 inches or a foot away and player A just walks up and just taps it in because that's habit to just go tap your ball in when you're that close, yeah, then we're gonna let that exist, and we're gonna let B have their chance. But if A misses, A's ball is gonna count and B's out of the hole.
Okay.
Right. So we've been pretty specific with how that works.
I like that. I love that. I mean, I love tap-ins in a scramble. So, but I've got one question. So A and B are putting for birdie. A puts it to 5 inches. Goes to tap it in and misses. Does B get to pick up his ball or her ball and place that beside?
Nope.
They lose nope. that opportunity. So now it's going from a birdie putt and they finish the other tap in and it's a bogey.
Correct.
Okay. Wow, that's awesome. That's a
right. Jeopardy. So it really puts the onus on, like, you know, if you're gonna tap it in, make sure you're gonna make it, right? Because your partner's still gonna have the chance. But if you miss,
I love it.
Wait, I might have that backwards. I apologize. I think we changed that. So I'd have to go back. So if A misses, we did change this. If A misses, A's out of the hole.
Okay.
So now B still has a chance to make it, but if they miss, or A in the hole.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, I think we changed that. I have to go back and look at the wording, but we've been really specific with how we handle it. I might have had that backwards because at one point we were eliminating player A. So yeah, so if A taps it in and misses,
then it's all up to there, B.
It's all up to B.
So B can still go for the birdie?
Correct.
But if they hit it correct. 5 foot past,
correct.
They have to make it for par.
On their own.
And they don't get okay, understand. Yeah. I don't mind it either way. I think the first one or the second one was pretty was pretty good.
Yeah. There's a penalty of some kind, not a stroke penalty, but there's a consequence.
A consequence
of a missing. Right. Like and the consequence of A missing is one of the players is out of the hole.
Okay.
And the other player's got to finish on their own. Right. So B's still gonna have the chance to make it. But if they miss and they miss by 4 feet, well, they're on their own the rest of the hole. A's out.
A's
taking all the chances.
That's really good because if it is 4 inches, tap it in, okay, they got four, guaranteed at least par or what, four, whatever, got the birdie. But if he does go to 5 foot, he smashes it past, then B is definitely thinking, well, I can't necessarily just go for it. I've got to lag it up, which is what you would do anyway. You know,
that's exactly.
If you didn't have that exactly tapping right option, you'd still do that anyway. So
so good. Yep. And the fact that we're looking at scramble and it's match play for most of this, right? We have some stroke play qualifiers to get into match plays once you get into the championship season. But think about that in match play. If player A puts it up to 6 inches, the other team can just concede that, right? Well, that's not going to preclude B from putting, right? So we treat the tap-in the same way, right? We treat the tap-in as though it were almost as though it were a concession, right? Yeah. If you tap it in and you make it, you made your par. The other team would have given you the par anyways. B's still going to have their chance for birdie in that scenario, right? So we're still going to let B have their chance, and that was why I think we reworded it. But you sort of get the gist. So those are the kinds of things we have to do. And when it comes to two players playing from the same spot, you have to mark the ball before anybody plays. If you don't, and you choose player B's ball, right, there's going to be a one-stroke penalty, right? Because there was no markdown in place. So you could, if player A plays the second shot without marking it, hits it out of bounds, and player B knocks their ball on the green, but you didn't mark it, right? You didn't mark the location of A's ball before he hit. Well, you basically moved your ball in play, haven't you?
Yep.
Right? So you're going to get that one-stroke penalty. You've put a ball back, and now you fit your next one onto the green, so you're going to get your one-stroke penalty. So we've incorporated some of those procedural things in what end up seeming like relatively convoluted ways, but we've really tried to keep along with the principles of the game when we do it.
No, I understand that one there, you've actually modified it so that you get a penalty if you don't leave your marker there, whereas currently it's if you take your marker, if you leave your marker there, you get the penalty.
Exactly.
So you have to take it away, but in your one, if you take it away, you get the penalty. It's quite funny. I actually played a scramble on a boys' golf trip a couple of weeks ago, and we had about 190 into the hole, yards or meters, it wouldn't matter, because we hit two terrible shots anyway. But one guy hits it in the bunker, and I go, yeah, that'll be fine, pick it up. And I proceed to hit mine lost in the bushes. Couldn't find it. He's like, just drop one. I'm like, no, we've got to play under the rules. He's like, just drop one. No one else is playing under the rules. Just drop one. And I said, no, I'll run back, put your ball back in the bunker, hit it out, and we'll take a one-shot penalty because we picked up your ball. But so if we sort of just go, that's an awesome. I'm actually going to try that format, a scramble match play. That's awesome.
Scramble match play. I'll have to send you a link to the conditions of competition we use. It has everything detailed in there, and you can peruse that at your own.
Actually, please do, because I actually on my blog on the golfrulesquestions.com website, I've written sort of suggestions to committees when they write up a scramble. I'm like, well, you know, you got to say whether you're going to allow tap-ins, how many people have to have a certain number of drives per 18 or 9 holes. There's like 17 or 18 things that you got to think about. You know, the putting the mark down, like leaving the marker down. Do you guys drop or place?
We place.
Yeah, we place
everywhere. You've got to place in the same. This is where we differ from the rules a little bit. You know, if you're in the general area, you got to keep in the same cut of grass.
Okay. Yep.
You can't go from rough into fairway.
Totally.
You can't leave a bunker, that kind of thing. We give, you know, a club length from where the ball, you know, from where the original ball was.
Yep.
We also play one of the things that we do, because again, you know, you remember you're talking about, you know, kids.
Yep.
Everything's only a one stroke penalty.
Okay.
So, and we usually will have within the local rules is that anything that's out of bounds, we play as a red penalty area, no play zone.
Good one.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, so we kind of keep things moving along a little bit, and you know, some of these things that recreational golfers do anyways, right?
Yes, exactly. Right.
There's no such thing as white stakes for a lot of recreational golfers, right. I feel like. So, you know, so we incorporate some of these things and just try to keep it fun and loose and relaxed, and we want the kids to make a lot of pars and birdies and eagles, because that's what keeps golf fun, right? So,
but we've stayed within
a lot of the parameters and the principles that kind of guide the game. With the understanding that, you know, this is supposed to be a little more fun and introductory competition than it is really serious, hardcore competition. And it's taken off. I mean, like I said, it's just like Little League Baseball, but for golf. And they're wearing jerseys with numbers on them and their last names across the back and everything. And it's been, I think we had nationwide, I think we had almost 30,000 kids in the program last year, around the nation, which is just awesome.
That is fantastic. So it's funny that, you know, that we've got that local rule E5 if people want to, committees want to adopt it. But as you just said, it's almost a better option that you just say no play zone, red penalty area, take your drop up there where you think it's gone in, one shot penalty. I think that's a way better option than adopting E5. I actually hate E5, but I like that option a lot better. Talking about kids and rules, how do you find getting them into understanding the rules of the game? And honestly, do you see them getting turned off by learning the rules?
So if you get a little too pedantic, yes, you'll turn them off. Right. But if you the approach that I take with getting the kids to learn the rules, you know, whether it's for my own juniors that I have at the club or if we're looking at it from a junior tournament, you know, bigger tournament standpoint, I try to help understand that the rules are there to help you as a player, not hurt you. Right. And if you know the rules, it can be at your advantage.
Yep.
When I'm introducing players to the game, I'll introduce the rules that are really necessary to know to finish the game first. Things like how to drop correctly from penalty areas. What does it mean to go out of bounds? What happens when you lose your ball? What if you can't hit your ball? But those ones that we're going to encounter on a routine basis, as that introduction to, you know, we are going to, you know, the rules are there to help you. Right. And I tell them, and I kind of get this with a lot of my juniors, and it's what I tell a lot of my members and other folks who are, who might be tutoring in the rules as well is, you know, there's really only two rules that matter. And that's you play the course as you find it and you play the ball as it lies. And all the other rules are there when you either can't or haven't done one of those two things.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're there to help you, you know, finish the round. And when you look at it, when I approach it that way, they tend to be a little more receptive. And then they start asking questions like, well, what if I hit my ball in that person's backyard? Well, what if a dog steals my ball? Well, what if, right? And they come up with all the crazy scenarios they can possibly think of as a 12-year-old kid. And then it starts to get fun to go down those rabbit holes. And I'm like, okay, let's back down a little bit because you're getting a little deeper than you really need to worry about right now. And we're going to talk about things you don't necessarily really care that much about. So let's just drop from this penalty area and call it a day.
It's funny. I think a couple of those kids are on TGRS, but maybe they're about 50 years old. Because some of the stuff that they come up with on that forum is unbelievable. But no, that's awesome. So your journey, you've done your work and you sit on a few golf associations and help out with those amateur events. And they're normally just one day events, Michael?
It depends. I've done some multiple day events. We actually hosted the Maryland State Amateur Championship at Chartwell, the club where I work, last year. And so it was pretty convenient for me to be an official multiple days. I was an on-course referee for one of the days of the stroke play qualifier, and then in the semifinals, I was a walking referee with one of the groups in the semifinals. So that that worked out pretty well over multiple days. And then I actually had an experience a couple times where for our PGA section, our section event, our section championships, a 3-day championship with a cut after day two. When I miss the cut, I end up officiating the third day. And so I tease the guys because in 1 year, I missed the cut and I'm out there and our rules official shirt for the week was a hot pink polo shirt. All right. Yeah. And so there I'm in the golf cart as a roving official the third day and see some, obviously all my friends are out there playing. And I'm like, okay, guys, I just want you to be this fair warning, okay? When you stink at golf and you miss the cut, they make you wear a pink shirt and look for balls for the good players the next day. and they all kind of laugh at that. So
yeah, I like that.
So those would be the multiple day events that I do is if I happen to be playing and miss the cut, or there's been times where I've even play the event in the morning and officiate in the afternoon on each of the days, or vice versa. So there's been some multiple day events there, which is pretty neat.
So with your journey, how long does it sort of take, or how do you get to, even just refereeing in the US PGA Championship?
So the PGA Championship would be, you mean the section championship or for a major?
The major. Can you set your sights, or is it just you have to know someone, or how does it sort of work?
So I've started having those conversations, and admittedly, I just haven't pulled the trigger on committing to being sending in information to the National Rules Committee. But the PGA of America has their own National Rules Committee, and I long term I do want to be a part of that.
Okay.
I've talked to a couple of different chairmen on a couple of different occasions, and some other members of the committee, and they've let me know what's involved, and have expressed interest in someone who is my age, which is not 70, being a part of the committee, because as you look at most rules committees out there around the world, they get older and older before they get younger and younger. So having somebody of my age that could do it for an extended period of time, I think is attractive from a committee standpoint. At least they make me feel that way.
Yeah.
I just haven't taken the opportunity to commit 3 or 4 weeks out of my year.
Gotcha.
to officiating those events. And that's just a personal thing, again, still working full time and having two young kids at home and just that time of my life. But it is something that I want to do. I can't imagine they'd put me on the PGA Championship my first year on the committee, but you never know.
That is a big reason that these committees, have a lot of 60 and 70 year, because they've got so much time. And we appreciate and love that they volunteer, or if they are paid professionals, that they are giving up that time to not just, go to these events and do the rulings, but also sit on these committees. But that is largely, why they're filled with that median age of 70 is because they are the ones that have so much time. It is quite difficult when you have a young family or even a young bride or a girlfriend, to give your time up. 12-hour days on, especially on Thursday, Friday, 12, 13-hour days, and then 8-hour days on Saturday, Sunday. that can take your toll. And if you're doing it as a love for, as a volunteer, which most people, when they start out and get into that journey, they have to give up your time for free.
Exactly, right.
It's like doing a traineeship, right?
But yep. it's not completely free. You get you usually get a polo shirt and a hot dog out of the deal. So it's not like there's no perks. they usually at least pay for lunch.
Do they pay for your petrol? That's probably more important.
Sometimes depends on how late in the day you stayed, if you gave any bad rulings.
But you know, this is fantastic. Like your journey, you know, the opportunity will hopefully pop up for you, and you'll grab it with both hands, because you are actually pretty passionate and pretty interested in the rules. I mean, you really do have to be interested to be where, you know, where we're sitting, and have those conversations with those people, because if you can't sort of just, you can't bluff your way through being a referee, I don't think.
No, it'd be hard to bluff your way through being a referee. And the you know, I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that my playing ability is not going to get me inside the ropes, so my rules knowledge better get me inside the ropes if I plan to be there.
That's right? How I thought too. Exactly.
And so you know, but what I do like, you know, again, you look at, get inside the ropes, and you always have backup, right? You know, you don't want, you want to be able to have the knowledge, but the book is always there to help you. The other officials are always there to help you. And you're never really out there by yourself when you're in those type of situations a lot of times. So, you know, that's always a nice thing to have, that sort of that backup.
Well, that's one of the things about being a good referee, is actually taking the time to step back and realizing you just don't know quite what to do in this situation. And you know, you get on the phone or you get on the radio, or even just, you know, it's a hard thing. I don't know how many times you've tried it. I've tried it once, and I think I'm never doing that again. But tried to read the local rules, or tried to read a part in the rule book, trying to find something when you're under pressure. I was like, I'm never doing this again. So I either studied harder, or I just got on the radio and said, hey, can someone help me out? And someone was there to help me out, which was great.
Yeah, I admittedly, I've been on the other end of the radio a few times where you know, officials is calling for asking for rules, or whatever, and I did, you know, I pull out my USGA app or the book, and I'm the one searching for the book, but I'm five holes away, right? The player doesn't see me looking through the book. I'm like, okay, so I'm page 487. We're looking at rule 16, you know, whatever the case may be. And like, okay, good, thanks.
Yeah, well, the player's not looking down on you going like this, trying to, oh, yeah, but, and then he's throwing stuff in your head. So, yeah, that's spot on.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, being the official on the other end of the horn with the rules book's a little more comforting.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I don't want to, I actually could keep going, but we'll have to cut this short just so to let you get on with your busy life and two kids and getting ready to go to Nashville tomorrow. But you do have the Golf Rules question of the week for us ready to fire.
I do. And it is this for all the listeners out there. When a player's ball is on the putting green, their line of putt requires them to putt through the fringe, and in the fringe there are two sprinkler heads. Are they entitled to relief for their line of play from an immovable obstruction on their line?
And if they are, where would they have to go?
What would they do?
I'm assuming you were watching the recent Waste Management Phoenix Open.
I was. Okay. And I posted that. I'm the one who posted that on the golf, on the TGRS, and I think it was a pretty interesting situation that came up. The way the announcers talked about it on the air made me believe they did not have a good knowledge of the rules.
I don't know if I said it before. If there's anyone that doesn't know about that has a worse rules of golf knowledge than PGA instructors, it's definitely commentators.
Yes, that is
shocking.
And unfortunately, a lot of times as commentators, it used to play.
Yes, That's right.
which is unfortunate, probably both during their career and while they're in the booth. But so, again, you got the officials now in the booth, which is nice.
So if their knowledge is lacking, then you can, as we said before, like recreational golfers have very little chance. But you know, I like what you said. You just have to know two things: play the course as you find it, and play the ball as it lies. And you know, if you hit it from the tee to the fairway to the green to putt, you only need to know about four rules.
That's correct. It's when you start doing stuff wrong that things get a little bit complicated.
Yeah. If you're on tour, you really only need to know rule 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, especially 19.
That's exactly right. Yeah, Rory doesn't know 19.
Rory got
19 wrong last week or 2 weeks ago.
On that back on the line, I mean, that was funny. Like 2018, you could drop it on the line and it could roll up to two club lengths. From 2019 to 2022, you could drop it anywhere within that half circle up to a club length from the line. And then they've gone back in 2023, they've gone back to 2018, but limited it to one club length. And I really like that. They should have done that from the start,
That's exactly right. Well, I think what ended up getting convoluted was you had the one club length semicircle that you had to drop it in, and the original intent was to keep within that semicircle. But again, looking back to 2018, you could drop the ball and it rolled forward,
yep,
and you didn't have to redrop it.
That's
so
right.
there was a trap there for the players that if they didn't select a reference yep. point on the line. And the ball ended up going forward, yep, you were going to end up getting penalized for playing from the wrong place. And so they introduced an interpretation, yep, and then it became a model local rule,
yep,
where the ball could, once it struck the ground, could move a club length in any direction, including forward, even if that got you outside that original one club length semicircle,
yep,
right? And so now you had one club length semicircle with no real reference point, and then this overlapping club length full circle that was established when you dropped the ball, and it got really convoluted really quickly to try to get rid of all the traps for the player, so they didn't get penalized for this wrong play stuff. And so, again, hindsight, like you said, being 2020, they were able to get it back to where it makes a little bit more sense now, and is a little bit more simple. But Rory just got it wrong.
And so did it wasn't quite back on the line, but so did Jaakko Niemann on Liv. He took two club lengths from the penalty area and then he thought, oh, I'll take two club lengths from the path. And it's like,
yeah,
when do you get two club lengths from the path? Now, Michael, this has been fantastic. I actually could just keep talking to you and I know that's why Fraze and I went for 3 hours, but I actually could talk and ask you a whole lot more questions. But we actually might leave that for another pod if you're keen.
Any time, I'll be happy to do it.
Thank you so much. All the way from Maryland, USA, thank you very much for joining me on the Golf Rules Questions podcast.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Cheers, mates.